And this was put together by Peter May again?
Pete did that, right.
What songs did you record?
A cover of Get Ready, which ended up coming out on our Sundays CD.
That's the Motown song?
Right. And we recorded The Come in the Morning and Necessary Person, the 45 was done there.
What is the version of the band now as far as personnel at this point?
Dave Dean and I, which were the only two original members left, Dave Brigette on bass, Mike O'Gara on rhythm guitar, and David Rifkin on lead guitar.
So Get Ready was never released as a 45?
It never was. I think there was some thought that it could be. It was a pretty cool version, and it was different than other versions, but somebody else had made a cover hit of that too, so it was probably too late on that one.
So who's doing the lead vocals on these two songs?
Those are both Mike O'Gara. He was probably our primary, I shouldn't say primary, we all sang and everybody sang some lead during the night, but he was probably the main voice at that time.
Did Peter May go out on the road with you?
Peter left after we left L.A. from doing, we did a session out there. We started working with a different agency, James Haynes Agency out of Kansas. I don't remember the exact dates, Tom, if that was prior to even that recording, but I know Peter was kind of slipping away and we were aligning with other people, but it was a transition period that we kind of never recovered from.
So you're playing quite often at this period?
We were playing, but we were playing a lot of different towns throughout the Southwest, Kansas, Colorado, Texas, Oklahoma, and Arizona, and we were playing pretty much one-nighters. So we were getting paid pretty good for the jobs, and we were pretty popular in those areas, but we were living gig to gig. We were making enough money to pay our bills and go to the next gig. We weren't making the kind of money we were really getting ahead. We used to call it retching. We were out on the road retching.
What does that mean?
Means you're struggling to make a living and trying to make things happen. It was a tough time because we didn't come home to Minneapolis very often. Pretty much that's the time where we lost our affiliation really even with the town, because we'd come back and only play a gig here and there, and then we go back on the road. So you say we come back for Christmas for a couple weeks and maybe do a gig and then we're gone again. So I think we were trying to do something at another level, but at the same time we were losing whatever we had going here.
What time period are you talking about right now?
That would be moving into 1969.
And how did the recording sessions in Los Angeles come about?
We got an audition with A&M Records, and we went out there, and Peter was still with us then. This is when Pete was with us. He got us in out there somehow for an audition, and that's all it was at the time. We did an audition in the Charlie Chaplin movie studio. It was quite a large building, huge building. And the record execs were sitting way back, kind of almost in the dark. And we were on this big stage, and we played about maybe a 45-minute set, just like we were playing a gig. Surprisingly, if I can say that, we really played well. We were a really good live band. We had energy. We looked good on stage. We were tight. We had good vocals. And we had a lot of excitement that probably never came across in vinyl, but the bottom line was they liked us enough to give us studio time at their main studio, and it was the time thing where you might get a 6 o'clock, 6 to midnight, you might get a 9 till 2. We were getting like just whatever we could fill in there, but it was pretty steady. So we went in there and recorded, something like 14 songs maybe.
Did you have any contact with Jerry Moss or Herb Albert?
Never met Herb Albert, but he was busy, I think, with his band at the time. But we did meet Jerry Moss, was one of the execs that was in the audience when we auditioned.
And who was doing the producing or engineering?
They gave us one of their studio guys. It was one of their house producers. He was a guy named Peter Palafian, and he had just finished up with like the Mamas and Papas and somebody else, but he was a well-qualified engineer, probably as good as anybody we had met up to that point.
And I assume at this time it's probably 16-track studio, or?
I think it was 16, from what I remember. There's some fuzzy time back there, Tom, but I think that's what the equipment was.
Did you record at another studio also?
We had a day at Wally Heider's, which was really a cool studio, and it was really popular. It had a different sound. We did two songs there, and it was just a one-day deal. But I think the night before they'd had like some all-star guys. I forgot who they were, but I remember like Felix Cavallari and Eric Clapton or something, something ridiculous like that, of these big stars that were, you know, in that studio, and, you know, there just a few hours before us, and we're going like, wow.
How long were you in Los Angeles?
We rented a house, and we stayed for a month, rented a house out in the valley.
Did you go out and see bands like at the Whiskey A Go-Go?
We did. We had a great time. The Whiskey was quite an inspiring night. We went down there for Halloween even. But we had walked into this bar, and there's, I don't know if we all went that night, because it was about maybe a half hour drive into Hollywood. We were north of Hollywood. But we saw a band. It was their first night out. The big billboards were up on Hollywood Boulevard and Wilshire Boulevard. So we get into this place, and it's Three Dog Night's opening week of playing for L.A. And they were the band, and so we watched them the first night. We were thinking, yeah, those guys are, yeah, they're pretty good. You know, they're kind of, we're thinking we're hot stuff, so we're not at that point thinking that they're any better than we are. But that same night, though, in the audience, I remember seeing Eric Burdon down there having a beer, other kind of famous people. And we went back there, down there the next night, and I was walking with Dave Rifkin, and we were walking up a side street, and Jimi Hendrix in a silver Corvette was about halfway up, and there was no other cars parked there. And he was talking to, if I can use that term, a nice young lady. He was kind of working the program. So we thought, my God, that's Jimi Hendrix. And we're kind of like, you know, trying to be cool and not get too excited. So we went up to the inner block and kind of walked back down slow again and got a look at him. And it was just, it was cool, because he was big then. And we went to the Whiskey that night. After seeing Three Dog Night the second night, we were in the mood to see a band. I remember sitting up in the upper level, and we realized how good they were. That was our competition for that particular month in L.A., and they said, Dave, that's how good we got to be, and we weren't that good.
Did you finish up an entire album there?
We did.
Roughly how many songs?
I think we had like maybe 12 songs. Can't remember exactly.
Just to get the record straight, on this recording session, who's in the band and who's playing what?
This is Dave Rifkin and Mike O'Gara on guitar and vocals, and Dave Brigette on bass, Dave Dean keyboards, and myself on drums. That was our final band.
Were you happy with the sound you got at A&M?
At the time, I think we thought it was okay, but we really didn't know how to make our equipment sound good. We kind of thought, you know, that was somebody else's job to figure out how to make, get a good drum sound or get a good guitar sound. And I listen to it now, and I like it, but I think my thoughts were that it was okay, but I didn't think it was great. And it wasn't great because of the studio. It's probably the way we played in the studio. We didn't get the same excitement and sound that we got when we played live.
What did A&M do with your finished product?
They just sat on it for a while and didn't really do anything with it, and waited and kind of and thought that, well, we might put it out, we might not. We never had a clear-cut answer what was going to happen to it, so we packed up and went back on the road and started working again. Peter left the band shortly after that, and that's when he hooked up with the guys out of Kansas. And they had some good connections, too. They were promoting us in, like, the teen magazines and things like that.
This is James Reardon.
Right.
And were you written up in a teen magazine by any chance?
The band was one time, and then I was in a magazine called Teen Beat, and it was a section devoted to the Midwest. I was in there with, like, a half or quarter page or half page picture and a little story about me. It was cool.
Was it a big deal for local bands to try to get out of the Twin Cities and make it big?
Well, that's all we talked about. We called it going national. You know, we didn't know what the hell that meant. How do you go national? But everybody wanted to go national. But we had great bands, and in my opinion, we didn't have the business behind us and the business people to get our city and the bands from our city out there. Maybe some of the musicians end up moving to another town just to see to get try to take the next step. It was hard for us to get in out of Minneapolis to get records promoted and play venues that were going to have some credibility that these guys are somebody. How'd they get to play in this place? It was hard at that time, I think, to make that jump. And so the only way we thought we could do it is you got to have a record on the radio.
So you're based out of Denver at this point?
We lived in Denver, but the booking agency was in Kansas.
Okay.
But we lived in Denver about 6 months, rented a big apartment.
What happened next to the band?
We survived an accident where we lost all our equipment. We were kind of stretched out, typical of bands not probably getting along so well. And we came back to Minneapolis and we played, this was in spring.
Of what year?
This is, I think, be 19, I was going to say 69, maybe it's 70. But we came back and we had one job lined up. It was almost summertime. We had a job lined up to play out at the prison in Burnsville. And that's the last job we played.
Did the prison have two stages?
They did.
One on each end?
Yeah. I don't recall who else played, but that was our last job. And we decided to take, we said, let's take a month off. Let's just hang out. After sitting around for a month, we just decided to break up and cool it for a while. And then people found other things to do. There was one time we came back during that stage where we had a chance to maybe reconnect with Twin Cities. And we were asked to play to front a show with Arthur Brown and then the Vanilla Fudge. And I came back from the Denver and was met at the airport saying, come on, we got to go over to the Met Sports Center. We're playing in like an hour, something like that. Didn't know anything about it. And we got there and there's like, you know, 15,000 people or something. The place is packed and we're up there setting up our equipment with our roadies, you know, because we were like a last minute deal, I guess. And we played a set and we sounded terrible. So, I mean, we couldn't get in tune and the sound was bad and it was just a mess. The writer for the Minneapolis paper said we were alchemists.
Alchemists?
Yeah.
What about
our friend John Bream? We turned gold into lead. So I met him a few months ago, and I'd never met him before, and I told him that story. He thought it was pretty funny, but it was pretty hard on us, but it was hard. That was one of the last couple jobs we played in Minneapolis, too, was that.
The band wound up on the East Coast at one point, correct?
We did. When we were living in Denver, we met a young lady who had connections, and she really did. Her dad was a big-time lawyer in D.C. working with some big government people, and they lived in a ritzy area of town.
Do you recall her name?
Yeah, Bonnie. I'll think of her last name here in a minute.
Bonnie Diamond?
Bonnie Diamond. Yeah. How did you know, Tom? Bonnie and Mike O'Gara started to hit it off really good, but she was friends with the guys in the band. She knew them, and Phil Ramone was her friend in New York. So she got us to go out there. We stayed at her family's place. They had a big house, and they were really nice. They treated us like kings and took over the basement for a couple of weeks, basically lived there. And we went up to New York City and auditioned for Phil Ramone.
Phil Ramone, a very successful record producer.
One of the best.
What happened?
The audition went really well. They asked us to stay in New York and offered us two things, which we botched. They gave us a cut of a song called O Calcutta, which turned out to be a big Broadway play, and they gave us some raw cut and said, what can you guys do with this? So we took it back and we listened to it and we thought, this kind of sucks, you know, this isn't really our bag, and, you know, why do we got to do this type thing? Pretty much didn't do anything good with it. We didn't know. This was an incredible break for us. This could have been the one, and we probably fit in better in New York than L.A. anyway. But we didn't do that, and then they offered us a job to play at a place called The Scene, which was a real hip place in, I don't know if it was Greenwich Village, but one of the villages. And we would have to play like the 1 o'clock till 3 or 1 to 4, and I think the pay was something like $500 a week. Not a piece, but for the band.
You're talking AM.
AM, play in the morning. Yeah, we do the late show, which probably in New York would have been pretty hip. But we couldn't afford to stay. We were pretty much broke. A couple of us had a couple $100 and everybody else was waiting for the next gig for spending money. And it's not like we blew money. It just cost money to be on the road and travel and have two vehicles and so on and so forth. We went back to Washington, talked it over, and decided to, that's when we ended up going back to Minneapolis.
What happened to Bonnie Diamond?
Bonnie has since passed away, but she actually is one of those people that says, I know this person and I know that person. She actually really did. And she was, friends with the guys in the band, and that was like a classic all-time great band, but we didn't follow through with that one. I think we were just not getting along that well, or we really, really wanted to work and grind it out anymore. We just hit the wall mentally. And
so you returned to Minneapolis?
I think that's right before we did that prison gig and then broke up. I don't have the time exactly right, but that was one of our last deals, and we should have done more with that one. I'm going to cry now.
It's all right. It's okay to cry.
It was good. It was all part of the trip, and it was all great, but that was, if I had to do that one over again, I think we would have done something a little different.
Let's talk about drummers some more. What did you think of Tom Murray with the Litter?
Tom was great. Tom was fast, energetic, good showman, rowdy, fit in with the Litter. They were a classic rock band. I mean, they acted the part, they looked the part, they lived it. Tom was very good.
How about Pete Huber from Joker's Wild?
Pete was a wild man. He was kind of the Keith Moon of the local drummers. He broke more sticks than anybody in the history of rock and roll music, and he played hard and fast and energetic and put on a great show. I always thought he was kind of like Keith Moon. He was just playing away like a madman, and I don't know if he bought cheap sticks or what, but he would break, they would be flying all over the place. I mean, it was a mess. At the end of a Joker's Wild gig, there was a lot of wood on the floor.
Did you ever see Bill Lorden with Gypsy?
I saw Gypsy just once before they went to LA, and Bill's probably one of the best drummers here as far as technically that probably played around here ever. I saw him at the Aldrich Arena in St. Paul, and I only saw Gypsy play once before they hit the road.
So things didn't go well out east, and you wind up back here in Minneapolis, and the band starts to wind down.
Right. Things went well out east for what we should have accomplished out. I mean, what getting the door open, things went great, but we basically botched the opportunity.
But that would be typical of many bands.
And we didn't know better. We were still young and not really in the music business. I think most of us went into the business at that time initially to have fun, hang out, be cool, play music, and you didn't really think of it as a business. At least I don't think we did until kind of after the fact, like, hey, this is a business, and you thought it was something you did for maybe 3 years, and then you did something else. Didn't think that it might be a lifetime of playing, or this band, we could be like, you see a band now that's been, was successful, it's, they're in their 50s and 60s, and they're still the band, and they're still successful. It's, I never saw that back then, and I see it now, or even the business world, all the opportunities in the music business, they're huge now, and it's all different now.
Did the Steel Roven play with Sonny and Cher?
We did. Well, with one of them, we played with Sonny. We did the Minneapolis Aquatennial Spectacular, which was a big show in summer, probably one of the first types of shows like that, and it was at the auditorium. And the featured group that year was Sonny and Cher, and the backup bands were us and the Del Counts. But Cher had a miscarriage prior to coming to the Twin Cities, so Sonny, the show must go on. He showed up, and they auditioned girls in the afternoon to sing Cher songs and do her parts, and it was real hokey and probably not very good. His band was local guys who practiced in the afternoon, kind of learned the songs. I think he had brought a music director with him, but he didn't bring a whole band. But he kind of just did a shtick. The Del Counts played first. They were dressed up in some wild Del Count outfits, and then we played a set, and we rocked as hard as we could and did probably a really good job that night. And then Sonny carried the show, and we hung out with him backstage a little bit.
Was he a fun guy to hang out with?
He was a nice guy, yeah. He was out there. He was pleasant, and yeah, we had our picture taken with him, which is one of my favorite old band pictures.